I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Israeli officials have begun calling homes in Gaza to warn them of impending attack and firing sound bombs to warn civilians away in an apparent new tactic to switch from targeting Hamas security compounds to targeting the homes of the Hamas leadership. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza is now in its seventh day. It was launched after Hamas failed to renew a ceasefire last month and instead ratcheted up the firing of its own rockets into Israel. Isabel Kirshner is in Jerusalem for the New York Times. Isabel, what are you hearing about Israel's strategy?
Well, the Israelis are saying that they're going to continue with this campaign until Hamas's ability or will to stop firing rockets is impeded and stopped permanently. So they're not really spelling out their strategy. They're not really spelling out where this is going. But we do know that forces are amassed along the border. There's a possibility of a ground invasion as well.
Well, and we are hearing a lot of speculation. An analyst on the BBC this morning said that she expects Israel to invade Gaza with ground troops by Monday. Israel is very aware that the world's attention will be turned back to the region after the New Year's holiday. But we also spoke to a reporter in Gaza City who said he thought that there might be a brief ground attack, but that there was still hope for an international broker. What are we hearing about that?
Well, I think Israel is willing to consider a ceasefire at some point. My impression is that it has certain goals it's trying to attain and would like to do that before any ceasefire is either imposed in any way or comes into effect. And Israel also has its terms and Hamas has its own terms for what an acceptable ceasefire would include. Now, nothing has been crystallized yet along those lines. No international proposal has yet reached the point, I think, of meeting the concerns of both sides.
Well, we know that Israel's foreign minister has gone to France and that the French President Sarkozy is expected in the region early next week. Is it expected that he will be the peace broker?
Well, that's one possibility. There are many countries offering their support, and the European Union is also pushing to come forward with some kind of initiative. The French leaders have already tried to initiate an idea for what they said should be a 48-hour lull in the fighting for humanitarian purposes, but that was rejected by Israel. The Israelis said that they're allowing humanitarian aid in anyway and there's no need to stop the campaign. One thing that we're watching is the effect of all of this in the West Bank as well. We're seeing today some protests after Friday prayers as people came out of the mosques. Certainly not a huge explosion of anger, but definitely a discernible rise in sympathy, I would say, certainly for the people of Gaza and even for Hamas. It's not usual to see Hamas coming out in the West Bank, and if they come out at all, then that's already a change.
What's public opinion in Israel? We've spoken to a Palestinian reporter, again for Reuters, who says that opinion in Gaza is very divided. Some people are very much against the Hamas rockets, some for them. Some are saying that the fact that Hamas is still firing rockets so deep into Israel is proof that Israel may have another Lebanon on its hands, an unwinnable war against a militant group. Others are saying Hamas is playing into Israel's hands by proving why Israel needs to take on the source of the rockets. What are Israelis saying?
Well, I think there's a very broad support and consensus in Israel at the moment, certainly in southern Israel, where the rockets have been falling on and off for years. There was a feeling of abandonment and of a kind of ineffective government response or no government response. And I think the public here has broadly rallied around the residents of the south and the idea that the situation had become intolerable and couldn't go without some kind of response.
Isabel Kirshner, reporting from Jerusalem for the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, on Wednesday, we spoke to a Palestinian enduring Israeli rockets in Gaza, but as Isabel said, a steady stream of Hamas rockets have been hitting southern Israel, if not causing as much damage, definitely fraying nerves. Sderot, an Israeli town about a mile from the Gaza border, lost power today when a Hamas rocket hit an electric cable. Mechi Fenda lives in Sderot. We spoke to her earlier about this constant rocket fire from Gaza.
seven or eight missiles fired at Beirut. But I know that also Ashkelon and Be'er Sheva were hit today by missiles. It is not easy. It's something we've been going through for 7, 8 years. They could come at any time of the day or night and pick up the family, run into the secure room. It's not an easy situation. The kids, the older kids, could be bedwetting at night. I have children sleeping in my bedroom. They're afraid to sleep by themselves. We've been living in Beirut for 15 years, and we never dreamed, in our wildest dreams, that we would see the victims of these Qassam missiles. But we have to stay and keep the morale of the town up. And unfortunately, a quarter of the population of the city has left over the past 5, 6 years because it's just too unbearable.
That's Mechi Fendel in Sderot, Israel. She contributes to the Living with Rockets blog on the Jerusalem Post website. We'll link you to it at our website, here-now.org. Well, let's switch gears to take a look at how a change in taste and technology can alter the balance of nature. The bluefin tuna, weighing in at half a ton and measuring 6 feet long, was until recently considered unfit for human consumption, but these days it's the world's most desired fish and the most endangered. So frenzied is the demand for bluefin tuna for sushi that a single perfect specimen sold for $175,000 in the fish markets of Japan. That's about $395 a pound. Given that demand, researchers estimate the breeding stock in the Western Atlantic is only 20% of what it was in the 70s, and they fear for the bluefin's future. Well, Richard Ellis is a biologist and author of Tuna, A Love Story. We spoke with him when the book was published last summer and began by asking, please explain the difference between the bluefin and the tuna in a can that most of us know.
Well, they're very, very different fish. The tuna that we get in cans are basically two kinds. The white meat tuna, and it's always labeled white meat tuna, is a fish that's actually called an albacore. Mm-hmm. And they're about 3 feet long, and they're shaped very much like all the other tuna, but they're not very large, and they're not endangered. The light meat tuna is a fish called a skipjack. Yeah. It's also a tuna, but it's called skipjack, and it's about 3 feet long and very, very plentiful. They'd have to be plentiful to supply all the cans of tuna that are sold around the world. The bluefin tuna, on the other hand, is the world's champion tuna. It's the biggest, fastest, most beautiful, smartest, most highly evolved, probably the most highly evolved fish in the world.
So bluefin, you just extolled its virtues. I know it's one of the few warm-blooded fishes, but what else about it has made people so passionate about it?
The people who are passionate about it are mostly the Japanese, and the Japanese regard the belly meat of the bluefin tuna as the most wonderful thing in the entire world to eat.
Is that recent?
Relatively recent. It only dates from the time that the Japanese were able to refrigerate fish in restaurants and in stores. This was not a Japanese custom before that. They either pickled fish or smoked it. Once they could refrigerate, and that was well after the Second World War, once they could refrigerate it, they were and freeze it, they were able to store it, and then they were able to produce it as sushi and sashimi, which has, in recent years, made them go crazy.
Well, and tell us more. I mean, obviously, suddenly it's become in favor for a taste factor, but there seems to be something else about this creature, some certain nobility to it or some difference between it and other fish?
Well, it's larger than most fish, for one thing. They actually can weigh 0.75 tons. They can weigh 1,500 pounds. They are probably, with the possible exception of swordfish, the most widely distributed large fish in the world. There are basically three types. There's the Pacific bluefin, which ranges from Japan to California. There's the Southern bluefin, which hangs out around Australia and New Zealand. And then there's the North Atlantic bluefin, which is the fish we're talking about, which breeds in the Mediterranean and in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's the North Atlantic bluefin that is in such serious trouble.
Well, explain why. Why?
Well, why is unfortunately relatively easy to explain. They breed in two places, in the Gulf of Mexico and the Mediterranean. The Gulf of Mexico has a lot of ways in and ways out, if you can just imagine what it looks like. The Mediterranean, on the other hand, has only one way in and one way out. And fishermen regard that largely as a custom-made fish trap. They wait for the bluefin tuna that breed there. They wait for them to reach a certain size. Then they catch them, they fatten them in pens, and they kill them and ship them all to Japan. It can sell for several $100 a meal. There's a restaurant here in New York called Masa, which has a prefix of $400 a person, and the main course is always one slab of raw tuna.
Oh.
A small slab, by the way. $400 a person here in New York. It's the most expensive restaurant in New York. It may very well be the most expensive restaurant in the world.
Huh. Well, picking up on something you just said, the fishermen who hunt for the bluefin, which, you know, they travel in packs, the bluefin, they capture them and then grow them further. I mean, explain that, because some would say there are quotas against, taking too much fish out of the sea. There are laws about bluefin.
Well, there are laws against catching too many. There are no laws against herding too many, rounding up too many. That is the loophole that the fishers in the Mediterranean were able to drive their purse seiners, their fishing boats, through, because there are no quotas. They're not killing any fish at that point. What they're doing is catching them. They catch them in a big net. They transfer them to another pen. They tow that other pen to a place that's off, another pen that's offshore, and they keep them in that other pen for 6 months, 8 months, feeding them daily until they get big enough and fat enough to kill and ship off to Japan. This happens in every single country in and around the Mediterranean.
How can that be? Because, you know, if the ban is on catching too many, how can they make the distinction between catching it and taking it away and farming it and raising it and catching it and killing it? I mean, it just seems like the same thing.
Ultimately, it ends up being the same thing. And they can get away with it because fisheries are very, very difficult to police. In fact, there's nobody policing this. There's an organization called ICAT, which is the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna. They meet every year, and they set these quotas out, at which point all the countries fish illegally and pay no attention to the quotas. The World Wildlife Fund recently called for a complete closure of the Mediterranean tuna fishery. The fish are that endangered. Guess what happened? Nothing.
Well, and as you point out, the worst thing about this kind of fishing, catching all the fish when they're young and then taking them off to a fish farm, raising them and then killing them, is that they don't breed.
Of course not, because they catch them before they're old enough to breed. So not only are they decimating the population, they're preventing the population from replicating itself.
So what's the solution? What about fish farming, for example? We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with our conversation with Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story. And later, today's the day, Massachusetts becomes the latest state to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. And there will still be civil penalties for lighting up, like a jaywalking ticket. But will police departments want to write those tickets up? Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with biologist and author Richard Ellis about the imperiled bluefin tuna, the world's most expensive and most endangered fish. Now, Richard says the demand for high-quality sushi, the belly meat of the bluefin, is high in Japan, and the willingness to pay for that around the world is going to mean certain extinction for the bluefin unless immediate action is taken. We spoke to him last summer, and I asked him about tuna farming. Now, Richard quotes Columbia University oceanographer John Mara saying, "Fishing in the ocean is no longer sustainable. Imagine." And he proposes aquaculture as a solution, not only for the bluefin, but other fish. But we know farm fishing has problems as well. So I asked Richard about that. What about pollution from waste products, fish getting sick or cramped in dirty pens?
Well, there are a lot of problems with it, but it has to be, as John Mara pointed out, it has to be seen as a solution, because we cannot keep taking all the fish out of the ocean and expecting them to replenish themselves. It doesn't work that way. You kill enough of a species and the species becomes extinct. That's what we're doing with tuna. We've done it with other creatures in the past. An example, of course, which has nothing to do with the ocean, is the passenger pigeon. The passenger pigeon used to be the most numerous bird in America, probably the most numerous bird in the world. We killed them all.
Well, is there any way the craving for sushi can be reduced? I mean, other foods have passed in and out of fashion.
It would be nice if everybody in Japan would say, yuck, I hate bluefin tuna, and then the market would collapse, and then the bluefin tuna could swim merrily for the rest of its existence. But it's not likely, any more than the Americans are likely to say, oh, we shouldn't be eating that much beef because, whatever the reason, nobody will have a hamburger anymore. It won't work. It's not easy to convince an entire country to stop eating something.
Well, meanwhile, research is being done into farming the bluefin tuna. You had the opportunity to visit a unique facility in Australia. It was like Fort Knox, pretty strict security. Explain.
Well, I went to South Australia last year as I was completing the tuna book, because I wanted to see up close what they were actually doing. And I'd had a certain amount of experience in Australia. I'd been there several times before. And I knew a lot of the people that were involved in this enterprise. So I went down there, and they very openly showed me their facility. They wouldn't let me take any pictures, but they showed me their facility. It's a facility that has a 790,000-gallon tank in which they were attempting to get male and female bluefin tuna to spawn. What they had done is they had replicated the conditions in which these fish spawn in the Indian Ocean, north of Australia. And when I was there in March of last year, they failed. The tuna did not spawn. So they had no sperm, they had no eggs. The tuna just kept swimming around in circles. And I came back and I wrote in the book, too bad, but there's still hope that they may succeed. In March of this year, in March of 2008, they succeeded. They got the bluefin tuna to spawn. They are now raising tiny, I mean, it takes a long time to grow a 700-pound fish. Tuna are born at about the size of a grain of rice, but still they are raising them. And in this lies the potential salvation of the bluefin tuna, because if they can do this, they will be able to sell the tuna at a lower price than the Mediterranean fishers, who have to spend a fortune penning them and feeding them and everything else and chasing them, and therefore might. I mean, it's certainly not a definite thing, but they might knock the bottom out of the Mediterranean market. If the Mediterraneans can't make all that money, in other words, if the Australians can sell their tuna to the Japanese, the countries in the Mediterranean won't be able to sell their tuna to anybody. They'll go out of business. The tuna then in the Mediterranean will be left alone, and they will breed and live happily ever after.
Well, I just want to read a little bit from the end of your article. Again, you have a book coming soon, but you say, the big game fisher sees the bluefin tuna as a sleek and powerful opponent. To the harpooner, it's an iridescent shadow below the surface. To the purse seiner, that's again the fisherman that pulls up this net like a purse, sees a churning maelstrom of silver and blue bodies to be hauled on board. The longliner sees a dead fish, you know, caught in his line, pulled onto the deck with so many other marine creatures. You go on and on. The tuna rancher sees the bluefish as an anonymous creature to be force-fed until it's time to drive a spike into its brain and sell it. But you end by concluding, those who wish to rescue the tuna from biological oblivion, it now has to be seen as a domesticated animal like a sheep or a cow.
Because if we continue to fish on these fish as wild animals, we will drive them to extinction. If we can breed them the way the Australians seem to be doing, we will change our attitude towards fish like that, which is okay. I mean, I would rather that we didn't kill these wonderful animals, but people do have to eat, and fish happens to be particularly good for you. And so if we can breed them like cattle or pigs or sheep, then everybody who wants to eat this tuna meat will be able to do so, and we will not feel as if we're driving them to extinction. I mean, nobody worries about how many cows there are on the Western Plains, after all. We keep making more.
Richard Ellis, his book is Tuna, A Love Story. We have time for a quick update. On Christmas Eve, we spoke with Jerry France, a 35-year-old disabled Marine who'd been stuck at Chicago's O'Hare Airport with his wife and teenage sons for 4 days, down to $10 in his pocket. Listeners were desperately asking us, how can we help, or what happened? Well, Jerry's on the line. Jerry, you were trying to get to Seattle. United Airlines told you to wait standby. So what happened?
When we got to the first gate, there were 47 people, and an older couple heard our story and offered up the 2 seats. My wife and I consented to just let the boys go on and go home and have Grandma pick them up at the airport, but this older couple gave up their seats, and we were able to get home on Christmas Eve.
Oh, so you had 2 seats for the boys, but this couple heard your plight, and they gave you their 2 seats. Let's say a thank you to the older couple that helped get Jerry and his family out of O'Hare. What do you take away from this whole experience, Jerry?
When the airlines go to the United States government for their umpteen billion-dollar bailout plan, I really do hope that Congress realizes how many people have been stranded by the airlines. And once you give them your money, they're done, and you just get passed through the line. And for all your listeners, oh, I give them all the praise that I have. They are in my prayers.
Well, Jerry France, you were very much on their minds, and thanks for your thoughts, and a Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, listener.
Okay, at least one happy ending. Back after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as of today, it's no longer a crime in Massachusetts to possess less than 1 ounce of marijuana. Now, does that mean everyone can now run around smoking pot? Well, no. If caught, you'll be given a civil citation and charged a $100 fine. But the new law, passed overwhelmingly on November's ballot as question two, has authorities baffled, one police chief calling it a train wreck. David Capel is his Berkshire County District Attorney and President of the Massachusetts District Attorneys Association. David, you say law enforcement is going to have problems with the law. Make their case.
Probably the most thorny question is right there on the street. If police find somebody who's smoking or possessing marijuana and going through the process of giving them a citation, is first identifying them. Unless they already know who they are, or the person complies and gives them identification, there's no statutory authority to demand identification. This is very different from a motor vehicle situation where you're required to have a license, you're required to have it on you when you're driving, and you're required to turn it over when asked for it when stopped by a police officer.
Yeah, so if you are walking along the street and you are smoking a joint, you can, what, give a fake name or not give a name at all?
Well, I suppose... It's not the right thing to do, certainly.
But that's what police are anticipating.
Yeah, there's no law requiring people to have an identification on their person or to provide that information. Plus, people still have to remember, marijuana still remains contraband. So the police are not only authorized, but they're obligated to seize it so that they not only would be able to take it if they see it, but if they have probable cause to search for it and to make sure that, in fact, you maybe only have one joint rather than having more than an ounce, which would turn it into a criminal offense.
So it's not a crime. It's more a civil offense like jaywalking, and you can get ticketed and fined for it. But there's no way of demanding identification. And we understand also there's a simple issue of citation booklets. Most police departments don't have proper tickets and have to print them. And one police chief is saying he's not going to spend money on violation books that he feels are going to be meaningless.
Well, this is another concern, not just with the booklets, but it's the whole idea of the bang for the buck on this and in enforcement. This $100 fine, there's going to be an awful lot that municipalities, especially the smaller towns, are going to have to think about to whether or not this is going to be worth it. My office will not be prosecuting these cases anymore. So some small town's going to have to either send over a town official or the local police chief, who may be a part-time chief, to come in on overtime to prosecute these cases. So that's a concern that municipalities are going to have to look at.
Well, one advocacy group, the Committee for Sensible Marijuana Policy Legislation, says they're in favor of the law because it'll save the state nearly $30 million a year that group estimates is spent on enforcing the old, harsher drug laws. And now you know the governor, Deval Patrick, has just announced another $1 billion in new budget cuts. you know, given that equation, isn't this a way to save money?
Oh, it's not, because you start off with an assumption which was wholly false, this idea of saving $30 million. The reality is that the vast majority of cases up until this morning, possession of marijuana, and they still will be, are attached to ongoing criminal investigations and offenses anyway. That's going to continue to happen. It's just going to now be on a separate track. More resources are going to have to be spent in order to now civilly process these cases. And so you're going to have the reverse of that. This is going to cost money. Police officers aren't on the street, aren't going around looking for people smoking dope. They're going after other crimes.
So I guess isn't that why Massachusetts voters overwhelmingly voted for this law? Because they feel it's a nuisance crime anyway. And so it's sort of maintaining the status quo but legalizing it.
Well, it's not a nuisance crime. When they're finding rapists and robbers and those with firearms and committing other violent offenses, they're finding marijuana. It's not a nuisance offense if it leads to other very serious offenses.
Well, it's also leading to some interesting contradictions. We were reading that under the new law, a police officer could actually legally, in other words, not criminally, but he could smoke a joint, but he could be fired for smoking a cigarette.
Well, that's one of the concerns, because the law specifically states that except as provided by the law, and they're talking about the $100 fine, the state or municipal governments or any agency or program can't impose any form of penalty or sanction or disqualification. And our concern is, just as you brought up, that a police chief finds out that one of his officers is smoking dope, not on the job, because that still would be affected. But yeah, right now, police departments ban officers from smoking cigarettes, but they won't be able to ban them from smoking marijuana.
Well, why is this law seeming to work well in other states? Massachusetts isn't the first to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. 12 other states have similar laws. Nebraska, for example, charges $300 for less than an ounce, and things have reportedly worked smoothly there for three decades. So what can Massachusetts learn from that?
Then perhaps we need to change this law to make it more in conformity with other laws. As I talked about earlier, question two specifically states that nothing other than the $100 fine can be done to anybody for possession of marijuana. That raised the specter of the police chief not being able to discipline an officer for smoking marijuana or possessing it.
So other states allow something beyond a fine?
Well, they don't have that provision prohibiting other action to be taken. Part of this, too, is that every state, that the laws that they've enacted have all been different. And whether or not it fits into the fabric of existing law is a whole question, too. We have a lot of civil penalties on the books, but they're backed up by a whole host of regulations and statutes regarding the motor vehicle laws and a registry of motor vehicles that can really give them effect and allow them to be enforced the way they were supposed to. We don't have that with this law.
Do we know if this law is going to affect whether public schools or universities can ban pot possession at school?
Well, again, that's a major concern, too, and people are wrestling with that. And I think ultimately it's going to have to be decided by the courts. But my concern is that the law seems to indicate very clearly that they're going to be able to discipline you for smoking a cigarette on campus, but not for smoking a joint.
But aren't state authorities urging cities and towns to enact their own laws against pot smoking? In other words, can a town do something to answer some of the questions about the state law?
Yes. In fact, question two specifically calls for or allows for municipalities to enact bylaws which would prohibit the public smoking of marijuana. But again, that would be the violation of the bylaw that still would not address the issue of whether or not a high school or college, or a middle school for that matter, can discipline their students.
David Capeless, Berkshire County District Attorney, President of the Massachusetts District Attorneys Association, on the new law in Massachusetts that decriminalizes possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. But David, we also just want to mention your dad, Robert Capeless, was a four-term mayor of Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He was later the state tax commissioner, well-known in western Massachusetts, and he passed away last weekend at 91, so we wanted to express our condolences to you.
Thank you very much. He was a great man. A wonderful, incredible example to his whole family and to the community here. He's well remembered, and I appreciate very much your thinking of him and condolences for me and my family.
Okay, well, as always, we'd love to hear from you listeners on the marijuana issue or anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org, or give a call, leave a message, 617-358-0397. We'd love to hear from you. Monday on Here and Now, the new Congress will have a preview. You're listening to Here and Now. That's the song, Drive Like I've Never Been Heard, from the latest chapter in guitarist Ry Cooder's California Trilogy, which started with Chavez Ravine in 2005 and My Name is Buddy in 2007. This CD is called I Flathead, and it's up for a Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Folk Album, a great excuse, as if we needed one, to revisit our conversation last year with Ry. I Flathead is an album of music by the fictional car racing roadhouse musician Cash Buck. That's K-A-S-H-B-U-K, and his band The Clowns, Clowns with a K, who are also characters in a novella written by Cooder that comes with a deluxe edition of the CD. It tells the story of Cash and his friend Shaky, a mysterious mechanic from another planet, along with various friends and enemies living in a bygone California filled with seedy dance halls and sinister plots. It's a world, as Cooder writes, where strange people are the norm. Well, that's my description of the CD, and when we spoke to him from the studios of KCRW in Santa Monica, he approved. Ry Cooder.
That was good.
Thanks.
That's the best I've heard that done. People say, what is this? I have a hell of a hard time.
Well, my next question was going to be, what are you smoking?
you have to get the word out. There's a story everywhere, behind every door. I think in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles that I remember when I was growing up, it always seemed like there was a story behind every door, all these little houses and people with their jobs and their lives, you know, not remarkable, not heroic.
And now you're sitting there in Santa Monica, and I'm reminded that there used to be all those wonderful little houses in Santa Monica, and they're gone.
That's true. You bet they're gone.
Well, your character, Cash Buck, is a car racer turned musician. Inside, he says he's about 1,000 years old. Here he is singing the song. I asked you about what you were smoking. Here he is asking, can I smoke in here?
Can I smoke in here? Can I sit down? Am I bothering you? Are you alone? Is my tie on straight? Do you rate me polite? Do I need a shave or... seem all right.
So who is this guy, Cash Buck?
Well, he's the kind of guy you would have met, like, say, in 1950 and 1955, working in a defense plant or working in the shipyards in Wilmington down in the harbor, or maybe in his particular case, in the meatpacking in Vernon. Just an ordinary white guy, and who likes honky-tonk music, because a lot of the people who came out here during the war and then after were from the border south, sometimes called Okies or Arkies or whatever, and they liked this music, and it grew up here as well. It was transplanted by musicians who came out here to work in the record industry, because there was a record industry here, and they started doing it in bars, and Leo Fender made guitars for them, and they like cars too.
Yeah.
They like to go fast and play loud.
Let's talk about the cars. The title of the CD, a flathead. Is that a type of engine?
Yes, it's a Ford flathead, introduced in 1932, small little V8, cheap to make, and it was peppy. You know, Ford figured that the average Joe liked to go fast, but he didn't have a lot of money to spend, so he could go out and buy one of these cars, and they made these flathead V8s. Ford made them until 55, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So there was millions of them, and you could get one for $10 and or $20 and soup it up. These guys had learned some technology during the war in Southern California, and there was a lot of cheap technology available. You could put fancy carburetors on these things and change the manifold and take it out to the desert, which was, you know, a 2-hour drive, and you could run this thing as fast as you could because you wouldn't run into anything because it was nothing but sand and Joshua trees.
You just bring along some Lucky Strikes, some donuts, and some T-Bird wine.
T-Bird wine, that's right.
And go out and drive. Let's listen to one of the songs. It's called Flathead One More Time.
3 o'clock this morning. I woke up in a dream. Thought I heard a flathead motor roar. I thought I smelled gasoline. A feeling came upon me that I ain't had in years. Something like a hot, dry wind whistling past my ears.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. That's the song Fernando Sez, S-E-Z, from guitarist Ry Cooder's latest CD, I Flathead. It's up for a Grammy Award, and we're revisiting our conversation from last summer to remember why. I Flathead wraps up a trilogy of records, the others are Chavez Ravine and My Name is Buddy, that pay homage to Cooder's home state, California. I Flathead features Ry as fictional car racing musician Cash Buck with his group The Clowns, the band and Cash's friend Shaky, a one-armed car mechanic from another planet, are also featured in a novella written by Ry Cooder that comes with a deluxe edition of the CD. And the novella includes maps, so you can trace the path these characters follow through this bygone world. So I asked Ry Cooder if this is a world he's yearning for.
Well, sure. I mean, Chavez Ravine and Buddy and this record are all really for me. What I am saying basically here is this is the life I remember. This is the time and the place. It's not like this anymore. You know, life is different now in Los Angeles, obviously. But I can remember everything, you know, I guess you'd say, like it was yesterday.
Well, I was thinking it's different, you know, on the other end of the continent. I grew up on Long Island, and, you know, we used to climb around in these hills and everything, and now it's complete suburbs. So there's been a lot of change. But you write about communities that have been uprooted. Your earlier CD, Chavez Ravine, was about a Mexican-American community that was just kind of bulldozed to make way for Dodger Stadium.
As L.A. grew, the people that planned it, who were the developers, the commercial developers, I call them the satanic builders. And they looked out and they saw these enclaves of poverty, or what we would call poverty, which was really just people who were working, people who lived their life and had their place. But it was easy to take that. You know, you couldn't go to Beverly Hills and say, I want Wilshire Boulevard for my next freeway. You couldn't do that. So you went down where they didn't have a voice or didn't have power, and you had the police to cooperate and the FBI to cooperate in case anybody waved a sign like these people in Chavez Ravine did. You know, they went down and demonstrated. It was a very early Chicano power, 1949. Don't throw us out. Don't do this to us. And then they had Chief Parker and J. Edgar rushed in to take care of that and scream communist, and it worked pretty well. Kind of thing they do today. It's never stopped, and it happens everywhere from Long Island to Santa Monica, you know.
Well, here in Boston, there was a community called the West End to go with the North End and the South End, but it was completely removed.
Yep.
Well, is this a quixotic thing on your part? You know, it's like shaking your fist against the windmill, or do you really think you can affect change? Or is it just about nostalgia?
Well, I don't trust the word nostalgia because I'm the same person I was when I was 8 years old. You know, I still like the same cars. I still like the same songs. So nostalgia is not a product for me. It's just what interests me. So I think to myself, let's propose this as a musical statement or as a narrative. And I like to do it, so I sit down and I do it. And I don't think any change is going to come, and it's never going to change. And anybody who thinks that just should come to Los Angeles and take a look at what's been done here by the satanic builders.
Well, but you have made change in the past. I'm thinking of the Buena Vista Social Club.
Oh, that's true.
Your appreciation of traditional Cuban music brought them back, or brought them out of the shadows to a lot of people. We're listening to their music now, and then Wim Wenders made a documentary about it. And boom, you know, you sort of bring a group of aging musicians into the limelight.
Well, it was a story that was there to be told. We were all, as Americans, taught to hate and fear Cubans. So I would say Is it Ruben Gonzalez you're afraid of? Or is Compay Segundo, he's the one you're scared of? And people would go, well, of course not. He's a wonderful man. He's a beautiful little man. Look at him with his hat and his cigar. I was saying, see, now you're not scared anymore. Isn't that interesting? Because Pete Seeger had this idea back in the old days that music would create a bridge that ought to be created between people who, in the class struggle, that could be undone pretty quickly by people singing in a room. And, of course, J. Edgar got after Pete. He couldn't have that message out there. It worked pretty well in the case of Buena Vista, and it showed the world that there was beautiful music, and these people were terrific, and they could like it. So, yes, that did make a change actually happen.
Back to I Flathead, your new CD. Yeah. Rolling Stone named you one of the top 10 guitars of all time. Congratulations. Mm. And you, or rather Cash Buck, your character, paid tribute to other guitarists in a song on the new CD. It's called Steel Guitar Heaven. I don't want to listen to some of that.
Steel guitar heaven, that's the only resting place for me. I wanna go to steel guitar heaven. There's a lot of swinging cats I've been wanting to see.
And you also, Ray Cooter, give a nod to country greats. There's a song called Johnny Cash, another one here called 5,000 Country Music Songs. Let's speak a little bit of your obvious love for music.
Well, when I was 8 years old in the fourth grade, one of my parents' friends, for a birthday present, gave me a little Sears radio. I twirled around on the dial, and I found this hillbilly station, and Johnny Cash was just coming up and starting. And Hey Porter came on. I was home. I used to find it reasons to stay home from school, and the radio became the main reason. I heard this tune. I instantly memorized it because I had a good memory, you know. So I heard Hey Porter, give me my bag. What time is it? Are we getting off the train? Is it going to be the South? Am I going back home?
Hey, Porter, would you tell me the time?
It's a fantastic song. I said, who is this? Who are these people? Where are they? Then I found out later on, a lot of them were in Los Angeles making records, but I didn't know that right away because I'm from Santa Monica and there's nothing going there.
Are you from Santa Monica?
You bet. Oh, you South Santa Monica, where the aircraft factory is.
Wow.
Douglas Aircraft.
Because your town has really changed.
Oh, brother, has it ever. Well, it's all mixed use now. It's all gentrified and ice cream colors and this and that. It's appalling. But I still live here because the weather's good.
Well, now you've written the music for that time, you know, bringing it back in that way. Mm-hmm. But into all of this, you drop this shaky guy, this sort of alien car mechanic.
Right.
You know, it's like in the future. Yeah. What's that about, this futuristic part of it?
Well, he's a fugitive. He's a noir character. He's doomed a bit because no matter what he does, his past is going to catch up with him. He thought he would blend in. He thought it would be an easy trip for him because he'd seen much worse. But it turned out Earth people are just as crazy as everybody else, and it's not easy. So finally Shaky says, I can't take it. He takes his family and they go out to the desert where it's, you can hide. People have always hid in the desert since John the Baptist, I suppose. So he goes out there, and he tries to make a life, and he's successful, and he runs a little gas station. He's got one arm. I knew a one-arm mechanic. And then they come after him. That's it. That's the end, you know.
I'll never drive through the California desert the same way again.
If you go to any of these localities, that's why I included these maps, you can have an experience, you know. You go to Trona, California, it's amazing. Go to Death Valley, go to see the Joshua trees. It is very rich, you know, even today. They can't wreck everything.
Keep your eye on that one-armed mechanic.
Use some cat.
Ray Cooter, with his wide cast of characters in real life and on his new CD, I Flathead, the songs of Cash Buck and the Clowns, also comes with a novella of the same name. Ray Cooter, thanks so much, and thanks for talking to us.
Well, you just bet.
Anything you prefer we leave with?
I would have to leave that to you.
Riding with the Blues
is pretty cool.
Yeah,
I like that one. The girl screaming, that's real.
I found her on
YouTube. She was riding in her husband's dragster, probably going 200 miles an hour, and filming and screaming. So I got permission to use it. I think it's terrific.
Okay. Ray Cooter, thanks so much.
All right.
Ray Cooter's latest CD, I Flathead, is nominated for a Grammy Award in the Contemporary Folk category. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
I hope you don't mind being free to pull up your treasure case. funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.